Warning, this podcast contains heavy spoilers for not just one movie, but entire franchises. We highly recommend going and watching these movies before listening to us as a companion piece that stitches all the timelines into one creepy, crime-ridden story. There will be no more spoiler warnings. We do not break character. After this, there is no turning back. You've been warned. Hit the music.
You are talking about the nonsensical ravings of a lunatic mind.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Hello and welcome to It's Alive Alive podcast. This is a true crime paranormal interstellar podcast covering unbelievable stories that sound like they were ripped straight from the pages of a Hollywood script. I am your host, the man of many names, the outlaw Harley Ray, the bruiser Bronson, Dr. H.R. Smokenstein, THC, or you can call me Josh for short. And with me as always is my very own scream queen, the perfect combination of beauty and brains, the brightest Smokenstein, the indie horror, the expert, the guts and gore, the gorgeous, sexy Amy Rose. How are you doing this week, pretty lady?
Good, even though you've been keeping me in suspense with the Herbert West story.
I knew it when you were over.
With what? The zombie stuff?
Yeah, admit it, you're a believer now. You have finally joined the zombie nation!
Like, no. Whatever progress you made in part one was completely undone by Herbert West. I love the story, though, and I do want to know how it ends for old Herbie.
It's just because you don't know the full story yet. You need to know the whole West tale to really understand the science behind the art of reanimation.
I can't see it happening. It's all a bit too far-fetched for me, to be honest.
Why? I mean, you see the reagent drug only works on the immediately dead. Is it any different to shooting a shot of adrenaline into someone's heart who's just gone into cardiac arrest or their heart has stopped?
When you phrase it like that, no. It sounds perfectly plausible, but that's the problem with the conspiracist's argument. You phrase a story in a way that suits your narrative. Like, yes, it sounds like a similar practice to giving someone in cardiac arrest a shot of adrenaline to kickstart their heart.
Yeah?
Yeah, but you fail to mention that as part of this conspiracy theory, the reagent only revives a fresh corpse to a somewhat cognizant state. The not-so-fresh bodies also return to life and continue to move and attack, their brains too fried from lack of oxygen to ever function correctly again. I've been doing my research, so I might have one or two tales for you too this week.
Interesting. Okay.
So are you going to get on with it? I want to know what happens in my stories. I'm dying to know if Herb and Dan hook up before the end. I mean, you could really feel the sexual tension in the story.
See, now I know you're not taking the zombie threat seriously. And what if they were a couple? Maybe they bonded over the dissection table one night and realized they were soulmates.
They didn't believe in souls. It's the whole basis of the work, so that would make them cellmates. Hopefully that's how this story ends, with Herb and Dan cuddled up together in their little government-owned studio apartment. Cellmates for life.
Right. Let's get started before Amy tries any more of her stand-up act on us. Last week, we left off with Dr. Herbert West and Dr. Daniel Kane as they search for fresher and fresher specimens. Specimens. I'm doing like fucking Sean Connery now. Specimens. Fresher and fresher specimens to experiment on in a bid to perfect Dr. West's reagent mix.
Any idea what was in the reagent mix?
No confirmed ingredients, just what has been leaked by whistleblower Dr. Howard Phillips. It's been alleged by him that the main ingredient came from the DNA of the Sumatran rat monkey. Is that right? Sumatran? Yeah. The nasty-looking simian can only be found on a remote skull island found in the middle of the Pacific Ocean between the United States and Asia. The monkey, which was discovered by the Allied forces during the war in the Pacific, led to the US starting work on their own reagent before discovering the work of Herbert West. West is said to have traveled to the island of his own accord sometime before starting college in the Miskatonic University in his hometown of Arkham, Massachusetts. And you'll be hearing that a lot because every story fucking has a bit of a lead into it, which tells you what happened in the story beforehand. And usually it's, I met him at the Miskatonic University. Anyway, we'll get into all that a little more towards the end. For now, let's get back into the confession diary of Daniel Kane. In this chapter, we see the doctors play with a new compound that essentially keeps a newly deceased body fresh for later reanimation. Essentially trying to stop the decomposition temporarily, allowing them to preserve brain cells, giving them the time to properly prepare for the delicate operation. I, honest to God, went through this story twice before I did it for the show, and I never realized that it does look like, it says here, like he is trying to come up with a compound that will stop decomposition after death. Okay. But what it appears to be in this is that he actually kills the guy. I don't know, make your own mind up and listen to the story, but that's what Daniel thinks, that's what I think, and I'm pretty sure that's what the police would think if they ever caught him. So let's do it with part four, The Scream of the Dead. The scream of a dead man gave to me that acute and added horror of Dr. Herbert West, which harassed the latter years of our companionship. It is natural that such a thing as a dead man's scream should give horror, for it is obviously not a pleasing or ordinary occurrence. But I was used to similar experiences, hence suffered on this occasion only because of a particular circumstance. And as I have implied, it was not of the dead man himself that I became afraid. Herbert West, whose associate and assistant I was, possessed scientific interests far beyond the usual routine of a village physician. That was why, when establishing his practice in Bolton, we had chosen an isolated house near the Potter's Field. Briefly and brutally stated, West's sole absorbing interest was a secret study of the phenomenon of life and its cessation, leading towards a reanimation of the dead through injections of the exient solution. For this ghastly experiment, it was necessary to have a constant supply of very fresh human bodies. Very fresh because even the least decay hopelessly damaged the brain structure, and human because we found that the solution had to be compounded differently for different types of organisms. Scores of rabbits and guinea pigs have been killed and treated, but their trail was a blind one. West had never fully succeeded because he had never been able to secure a corpse sufficiently fresh. What he wanted were bodies from which vitality had only just departed, bodies with every cell intact and capable of receiving again the impulse towards that mode of motion called life. There was hope that this second and artificial life might be made perpetual by repetitions of the injection, but we had learned that an ordinary natural life would not respond to the action. To establish the artificial motion, natural life must be extinct. The specimens must be very fresh, but genuinely dead. The awesome quest had begun when West and I were students at the Miskatonic University Medical School in Arkham, vividly conscious for the first time of the thoroughly mechanical nature of life. That was 7 years before, but West looks scarcely a day older now. He was small, blonde, clean-shaven, soft-voiced, and spectacled, with only an occasional flash of a cold blue eye to tell of the hardening and growing fanaticism of his character under the pressure of his terrible investigations. Our experience had often been hideous in the extreme, the results of defective reanimation when lumps of graveyard clay had been galvanized into morbid, unnatural, and brainless motions by various modifications of the vital solution. One thing had uttered a nerve-shattering scream, another had risen violently, beat us both into unconsciousness and run amok in a shocking way before it could be placed behind the silent bars. Still another, a monstrosity, had clawed out of its own shallow grave and done a deed. West had had to shoot that object. We could not get bodies fresh enough to sue any trace of reason when reanimated, so had perforce created nameless horrors. It was disturbing to think that one, perhaps two, of our monsters still lived. That thought haunted us shadowingly, till finally West disappeared under frightful circumstances. But at the time of the scream in the cellar laboratory of the isolated Bolton cottage, our fears were subordinate to our anxiety for extremely fresh specimens. West was more avid than I, so that it almost seemed to me that he looked half covetously at any very healthy living physique. It was in July 1930 that the bad luck regarding specimens began to turn. I had been on a long visit to my parents in Illinois, and upon my return found West in a state of singular elation. He had, he told me excitedly, in all likelihood solved the problem of freshness through an approach from an eternally new angle, that of artificial preservation. I had known that he was working on a new and highly unusual embalming compound and was not surprised that it had turned out well, but until he had explained the details I was rather puzzled as to how such a compound could help in our work, since the objectionable staleness of the specimens was largely due to delay occurring before we secured them. This, I now saw, West had clearly recognized, creating his embalming compound for future rather than immediate use, and trusting to faith to supply again some very recent and unburied corpses, as it had years before when we obtained the fighter killed in the Bolton. At last, fate had been kind, so that on this occasion there lay in the secret cellar laboratory a corpse whose decay could not by any possibility have begun. What would happen on reanimation, and whether we could hope for a revival of mind and reason, West did not venture to predict. The experiment would be a landmark in our studies, and he had saved the new body for my return, so that both might share the spectacle in accustomed fashion. West told me how he had obtained the specimen. It had been a vigorous man, a well-dressed stranger, just off the train on his way to transact some business with the Bolton Worstead Mills. The walk through the town had been long, and by the time the traveller paused at our cottage to ask the way to the factories, his heart had become greatly overtaxed. He had refused a stimulant and had suddenly dropped dead only a moment later. The body, as might be expected, seemed to West a heaven-sent gift. In his brief conversation, the stranger had made it clear that he was unknown in Bolton, and a search of his pockets subsequently revealed him to be one Robert Levitt of St. Louis, apparently without a family to make instant inquiries about his disappearance. If this man could not be restored to life, no one would know of our experiment. We buried our materials in a dense strip of woods between the house and a potter's field. If, on the other hand, he could be restored, our fame would be brilliantly and perpetually established. So without delay, West had injected into the body's wrist the compound which would hold it fresh for use after my arrival. The matter of the presumably weak heart, which, to my mind, imperiled the success of our experiment, did not appear to trouble West extensively. He hoped at last to obtain what he had never obtained before, a rekindled spark of reason and perhaps a normal living creature. So on the night of July 18, 1930, Herbert West and I stood in the cellar laboratory and gazed at a white, silent figure beneath the dazzling arc light. The embalming compound had worked uncannily well, for as I stared fascinatingly at the sturdy frame which had lain 2 weeks without stiffening, I was moved to seek West's assurance that the thing was really dead. This assurance he gave readily enough, reminding me that the reanimating solution was never used without careful tests as to life, since it could have no effect if any of the original vitality were present. As West proceeded to take preliminary steps, I was impressed by the vast intricacy of the new experiment, an intricacy so vast that he could trust no hand less delicate than his own. Forbidding me to touch the body, he first injected a drug into the wrist just beside the place his needle had punctured when injecting the embalming compound. This, he said, was to neutralize the compound and release the system to a normal relaxation so that the reanimating solution might freely work when injected. Slightly later, when a change and a gentle tremor seemed to affect the dead limbs, West stuffed the pillow-like object violently over the twitching face, not withdrawing it until the corpse appeared quiet and ready for our attempt at reanimation. The pale enthusiast now applied some last perfunctory tests for absolute lifelessness, withdrew satisfied, and finally injected into the left arm an accurately measured amount of the vital elixir, prepared during the afternoon with a greater care than he would use since college days, when our feet were new and groping. I cannot express the wild, breathless suspense with which we waited for results on this first really fresh specimen. The first we could reasonably expect to open its lips in rational speech, perhaps to tell of what it had seen beyond the unfathomable abyss. West was a materialist, believing in no soul and attributing all working of consciousness to bodily phenomena. Consequently, he looked for no revelation of hideous secrets from gulfs and caverns beyond death's barriers. I did not wholly disagree with him theoretically, yet held vague instinctive remnants of a primitive faith of my forefathers, so that I could not help eyeing the corpse with a certain amount of awe and terrible expectation. Besides, I could not extract from my memory that hideous, inhuman shriek we heard on the night we tried our first experiment in the deserted farmhouse at Arkham. Very little time had elapsed before I saw the attempt was not to be a total failure. A touch of colour came to the cheeks, hitherto chalk white, and spread out under the curiously ample stubble of sandy beard. West, who had his hand on the pulse of the left wrist, suddenly nodded significantly, and almost simultaneously a mist appeared on the mirror inclined above the body's mouth. There followed a few spasmodic muscular motions, and then an audible breathing and visible motion of the chest. I looked at the closed eyelids and thought I detected a quivering. Then the lids opened, sewing eyes which were grey, calm and alive, but still unintelligent and not even curious. In a moment of fantastic whim, I whispered questions to the reddening ears, questions of other worlds of which the memory might still be present. Subsequent terror drove them from my mind, but I think the last one, which I repeated, was, "Where have you been?" I do not yet know whether I was answered or not, for no sound came from the well-shaped mouth. But I do know that at that moment I firmly thought the thin lips moved silently, forming syllables I would have vocalized as "only now," if that phrase had possessed any sense or relevancy. At that moment, as I say, I was elated with the conviction that one great goal had been attained, and that for the first time a reanimated corpse had uttered distinct words impelled by actual reason. In the next moment, there was no doubt about the triumph, no doubt that the solution had truly accomplished, at least temporarily, its full mission of restoring rational and articulate life to the dead. But in that triumph, there came to be the greatest of all horrors. Not horror of the thing that spoke, but of the deed that I had witnessed, and of the man with whom my professional fortunes were joined. For that very fresh body, at last writing into full and terrifying consciousness, with eyes dilated at the memory of its last scene on earth, threw out its frantic hands in a life and death struggle with the air, and suddenly collapsing into a second and final dissolution from which there could be no return, screamed out the cry that will ring eternally in my aching brain. "Help! Keep off, you cursed little toehead fiend! Keep that damn needle away from me!" Kids can't get enough of that blood, guts and gore, then head on over to our Patreon, where for just $5 a month you'll get exclusive access to our true crime show Real Monsters and horrific history tales from Playing with Bones with Amy Rose, along with early access to our minisodes and ad-free access to everything else. All this and loads more horror-tastic extras from the Horrorverse. So what are you waiting for? Permission? Go nick your parents' card today and subscribe now at patreon.com/itsalivealivepod. Remember, that's It's Alive Alive Podcast, the really, really fake true crime horror podcast. It's Alive Alive, all the guts and gore with none of the guilt. So what did you think of that?
Even more far-fetched than the last episode, but it's still a fun story. I found a story from another whistleblower that might interest you though.
Go for it.
Okay, so this comes from the testimony of former army officer Colonel Glover and has been partially corroborated by his wife Ethel.
How can she partially corroborate something?
Well, she corroborated that her husband had received phone calls at certain times and his reaction after those calls, and that he'd been locked in his office for hours afterwards and usually ended up leaving the home for a few days after. She also said that he confided in her after the events of the story I'm about to tell you. The guilt got too much for him.
Oh, juicy. I can't wait.
He confessed his story to the media in 1985. He claimed that after the events in Pennsylvania, the government did temporarily suspend research and experimentation of trioxin-245 in 1969, with the remaining cans of the stuff set to be transported and stored in a base close to Louisville, Kentucky. Due to some miscommunication, one shipment of trioxin got mixed in with a delivery to a medical storage facility close to the Kentucky base. The company called UNITA thought nothing of it, having housed one or two smaller level classified specimens in the past. So they stored the cans in their secure safe locker, and the cans were forgotten about for around 17 years.
I know this company. Have you heard of this company? They're still in business. Yeah. Do you know why they call that? You need a, we got it.
That's
really the slogan.
You need a, we got it. Nice. So when I say those cans were forgotten about, they were almost forgotten about. You see, the missing cans played constantly on the colonel's mind, who had seen firsthand the devastation brought on by the chemical in 1968. He said throughout those 17 years, he waited on edge, just waiting for the day he knew would eventually come, when the chaos would finally erupt. That day came on the 3rd of July 1984, when while a new employee was being trained in at UNITA, one of the old canisters got cracked open, emitting the poisonous gas on the unsuspecting employees and in turn the whole small town of Dilliford. The colonel claims that after only a few hours, the town was too far gone for the virus to be contained in the same way that it was in Pennsylvania. And with no other option available, the decision was made to wipe the whole town off the map, dropping the mini nuke you spoke of in part one on the town, then claiming the small town was a victim to a massive gas leak from the local gas distribution station, which ran in pipes to every home and business in the town. It was the primary source of heating in the town.
Yeah, I've heard of the gas blast disaster at Dillyfield, right? Never heard of the trioxin link before, though. Even though I always did find it suspicious, and so did other conspiracy theorists, as to why people weren't allowed on that land anymore.
Well, there you go.
Radioactive. Wonder if you'd find... wonder if you'd find some zombies there, but I mean mutants. Mutants. Any mutants there?
Oh, yeah, be political.
If you find zombies there, they didn't do their job, right?
I thought you were just being politically correct. I forgot for a minute.
Well, look, at least I know I've accomplished one thing today. If you're looking up your own research and digging into it a bit, then I know you're in the conspiracy world now. You're one of us.
All I need now is a pot of bad coffee and a tinfoil hat, and I'll be fully part of
it. One of us, Google.
Sounds like a pain in the hole finding bodies for his research. And do you think the last guy really died of a heart attack, or do you think West just took it upon himself to make a research specimen out of a stranger, especially if the guy really told him that he had no family?
Oh, I think he definitely killed him. I mean, who tells someone they just met their whole life story? How could he have known this salesman had no family? I think he just told Kane that to keep him happy. What he doesn't know won't hurt him, kind of logic. But I think that logic goes out the door after he put the pillow over the man's face at the end before he injected him. No, he never really specified that he was alive. Maybe he was just making sure. Maybe it was part of his because he always made 100% sure the body was dead before he put in the reagent. Okay. So maybe he was just making sure. But I mean, it did look like it did sound like he killed them right in front of Kane.
Yeah, maybe we should look into that. I mean, maybe West is an unidentified serial killer.
I doubt it. I mean, I think he was responsible for more deaths, both directly and indirectly, but I don't think he liked killing. I'd say if he killed that salesman, it was probably his one and only kill until he went to work in the research facility. Okay. I think the proof for that is our next story, as West and Kane enter the Second World War in search of fresh specimens. Mm-hmm. This one is called Part 5, The Horror from the Shadows. Many men have related hideous things not mentioned in print, which happened on the battlefields of the world's second great war. Some of these things have made me faint, others have convulsed me with devastating nausea, while still others have made me tremble and look behind me in the dark. Yet despite the worst of them, I believe I can myself relate to the most hideous thing of all, the shocking, the unnatural, and the unbelievable horror from the shadows. In 1939, I was a physician with the rank of First Lieutenant in the Canadian Regiment of the West Indies, one of many Americans to precede the government itself into the gigantic struggle. I had not entered the army on my own initiative, but rather as a natural result of the enlistment of the man whose indispensable assistant I was, the celebrated Boston surgical specialist Dr. Herbert West. Dr. West had been avid for a chance to serve as surgeon in a great war, and when the chance had come, he carried me with him almost against my will. There were reasons why I would have been glad to let the wars separate us, reasons why I found the practice of medicine and the companionship of West more and more irritating. But when he had gone to Ottawa and through a colleague's influence secured a medical commission as major, I could not resist the imperious persuasion of one determined that I should accompany him in my usual capacity. When I say that Dr. West was avid to serve in battle, I do not mean to imply that he was either naturally warlike or anxious for the safety of civilization. Always an ice-cold intellectual machine, slight, blonde, blue-eyed and spectacled, I think he secretly sneered at my occasional material enthusiasms and censures of supine neutrality. There was, however, something he wanted in the embattled Pacific, and in order to secure it, he had assumed a military exterior. What he wanted was not a thing which many persons want, but something connected with a peculiar branch of medical science which he had chosen quite clandestinely to follow, and in which he had achieved amazing and occasionally hideous results. It was, in fact, nothing more or less than an abundant supply of freshly killed men in every stage of dismemberment. Herbert West needed fresh bodies because his life work was to reanimate the dead. This work was not known to the fashionable clientele who had so swiftly built up his fame after his arrival in Boston, but was only too well known to me, who had been his closest friend and sole assistant since the old days in the Miskatonic University Medical School at Arkham. It was in these college days that he had begun his terrible experiments, first on small animals and then on human bodies shockingly obtained. There was a solution which he injected into the veins of dead things, and if they were fresh enough, they responded in strange ways. He had had much trouble in discovering the proper formula, for each type of organism was found to need a stimulus especially adapted to it. Terror stalked him when he reflected on his partial failures, nameless things resulting from imperfect solutions or from bodies insufficiently fresh. A certain number of these failures had remained alive. One was in an asylum while others had vanished. And as he thought of conceivable yet virtually impossible eventualities, he often shivered beneath his usual stolidity. West had soon learned that absolute freshness was the prime requisite for useful specimens, and had accordingly resorted to frightful and unnatural expeditions in body snatching. In college and during our early practice together in the factory town of Bolton, my attitude towards him had been largely one of fascinated admiration. But as his boldness and methods grew, I began to develop a gnawing fear. I did not like the way he looked at healthy living bodies, and then there came a nightmarish session in the cellar laboratory when I learned that a certain specimen had been a living body when he secured it. That was the first time he had ever been able to revive the quality of rational thought in a corpse, and his success obtained at such a loathsome cost had completely hardened him. Of his methods in the intervening 5 years, I dare not speak. I was held to him by sheer force of fear and witnessed sights that no human tongue could repeat. Gradually, I came to find Herbert West himself more horrible than anything he did. That was when it dawned on me that this once normal scientific zeal for prolonging life had subtly degenerated into a mere morbid and ghoulish curiosity and secret sense of charnel picturesqueness. His interest became a hellish and perverse addiction to the repellently and fiendishly abnormal. He gloated calmly over artificial monstrosities which would make most healthy men drop dead from fright and disgust. He became, behind his pallid intellectuality, a fastidious Baudelaire of physical experiment, a languid Elagabalus of the tombs. Danger he met unflinchingly, crimes he committed unmoved. I think the climax came when he had proved his point that rational life can be restored, and had sought new worlds to conquer by experimenting on the reanimation of detached parts of bodies. He had wild and original ideas on the independent vital properties of organic cells and nerve tissues separated from natural physiological systems, and had achieved some hideous preliminary results in the form of never dying, artificially nourished tissue obtained from the nearly hatched eggs of an indescribable tropical reptile. Two biological points he was exceedingly anxious to settle. First, whether any amount of consciousness and rational action can be possible without the brain, proceeding from the spinal cord and various nerve centers, and second, whether any kind of eternal, intangible relation distinct from the material cells may exist to link the surgically separated parts of what was previously been a single living organism. All this research work required a prodigious supply of freshly slaughtered human flesh, and that was why Herbert West had entered the Second Great World War. The phantasmal, unmentionable thing occurred one midnight late in March 1942 in a field hospital behind the lines in the West Indies. I wonder even now if it could have been uttered in a demonic dream of delirium. West had a private laboratory in an east room of the barn-like temporary edifice, assigned him on his plea that he was devising new and radical methods for the treatment of hitherto hopeless cases of maiming. There he worked like a butcher in the midst of his gory wares. I could never get used to the levity with which he handled and classified certain things. At times he actually did perform marvels of surgery for the soldiers, but his chief delights were of a less public and philanthropic kind, requiring many explanations of sounds which seemed peculiar even amidst the babble of the damned. Among these sounds were frequent revolver shots, surely not uncommon on a battlefield, but distinctly uncommon in a hospital. Dr. West's reanimated specimens were not meant for long existence or large audiences. Besides human tissue, West employed much of the reptile embryo tissue which he had cultivated with such singular results. It was better than human material for maintaining life in organless fragments, and that was now my friend's chief activity. In a dark corner of the laboratory, over a queer incubating burner, he kept a large covered vat full of this reptilian cell matter, which he manipulated and grew puffily and hideously. On the night of which I speak, we had a splendid new specimen. A man at once physically powerful and of such high mentality that a sensitive nervous system was assured. It was rather ironic, for he was the officer who had helped West to his commission, and who was now to have been our associate. Moreover, he had in the past secretly studied the theory of reanimation to some extent under West. Major Sir Eric Morland Chaplin Lee, DSO, was the greatest surgeon in our division and had been hastily assigned to the West Indies sector when news of the heavy fighting reached headquarters. He had come in an airplane piloted by the intrepid Lieutenant Ronald Hill, only to be shot down when directly over his destination. The fall had been spectacular and awful. Hill was unrecognizable afterwards, but the wreck yielded up the great surgeon in a nearly decapitated but otherwise intact condition. West had greedily seized the lifeless thing which had once been his friend and fellow scholar, and I shuddered when he finished severing the head, placed it in his hellish vat of pulpy reptile tissue to preserve it for future experiments, and proceeded to treat the decapitated body on the operating table. He injected new blood, joined certain veins, arteries and nerves at the headless neck, and closed the ghastly aperture with engrafted skin from an unidentified specimen which had borne an officer's uniform. I knew what he wanted, to see if his highly organized body could exhibit without its head any of the signs of mental life which had distinguished Sir Eric Morland Chaplin Lee. Once a student of reanimation, his silent trunk was now gruesomely called upon to exemplify it. I can still see Herbert West under the sinister electric light as he injected his reanimation solution into the arm of the headless body. The scene I cannot describe. I should faint if I tried it. For there is madness in a room full of classified channel things, with blood and lesser human debris almost ankle deep in the slimy floor, and with a hideous reptilian abnormality sprouting, bubbling and baking over a winking bluish green spectre of dim flame in a far corner of the black shadows. The specimen, as West repeatedly observed, had a splendid nervous system. Much was expected of it, and as a few twitching motions began to appear, I could see the feverish interest on West's face. He was ready, I think, to see proof of his increasingly strong opinion that consciousness, reason, and personality can exist independently of the brain. That man has no central connective spirit, but is merely a machine of nervous matter, with each section more or less complete in itself. In one triumphant demonstration, West was about to relegate the mystery of life to the category of myth. The body now twitched more vigorously, and beneath our avid eyes commenced to heave in a frightful way. The arms stirred disquietingly, the legs drew up, and various muscles contracted in a repulsive kind of writhing. Then the headless thing threw out its arms in a gesture which was unmistakable, one of desperation. An intelligent desperation, apparently sufficient to prove every theory of Herbert West's. Certainly the nerves were recalling the man's last act in life, the struggle to get free of a falling aeroplane. What followed, I shall never positively know. It may have been wholly a hallucination from the shock caused at that instant by the sudden and complete destruction of the building in a cataclysm of German shellfire. Who can gainsay it, since West and I were the only proven survivors? West liked to think that before his recent disappearance, but there were times when he could not, for it was strange that we both had the same hallucination. The hideous occurrence itself was very simple, notable only for what it implied. The body on the table had risen with a blind and terrible groping, and we had heard a sound. I should not call that sound a voice, for it was too awful, and yet its timbre was not the most awful thing about it. Neither was its message. It had merely screamed, "Jump, Ronald! For God's sake, jump!" The awful thing was its source, for it had come from the large covered vat in that ghoulish corner of crawling black shadows.
So now we have dismembered heads controlling their bodies from afar. Like, how the fuck is the body supposed to be here at the head? Like, it has no fucking ears. The head is talking to itself.
Yeah, all I can picture is Nixon in Futurama.
And I thought my next story was ridiculous. So in England in 2004, there was an alleged zombie-like virus released by terrorists in the Crouch End of London. Only lasting 24 hours, the area saw infected people become rabid in a similar way to that of the infected in Pennsylvania. Unlike Pennsylvania, though, the virus didn't spread quite as fast or as far as the US trioxin. By the time it was all said and done, the virus spread throughout a small 10-mile radius all round, centred by a bar called the Winchester Pub. In this pub, survivors waited out the epidemic by barricading the exits and windows. They then spent the next few days in a drunken haze, forgetting about their problems in what they thought would be their last party. The attack saw over 100 people lose their lives and left another 200 with life-altering issues. The government's official story was that it was a terrorist attack on Britain using chemical weapons, although the type or name of the chemical in question has never been released to the public.
Yeah, when it's so close after 9/11 in 2001, people just accepted terrorist acts as a thing that could happen at any time, especially in the UK and the US.
Yeah, it was a bit of a catch-all in the early 2000s for any kind of sanctioned warfare.
Especially if they wanted to get oil from your country.
Okay, it's honesty time. We have a confession to make. We suck at socials. No good at Insta. Can't send a tweet or an X or whatever that super villain looking motherfucker is calling it now. Stick to your space cars, Elon. But we know you want to chat. You want to be kept updated. You want to be alive, alive all the goddamn time. So we're getting down from the anti-social soapbox and giving this a try. So come chat to us on Insta and Twitter at Alive Alive Pod, or hit us up by email at itsalivealivepod@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. This is a project. It's still a work in progress, and we just want to give you more what you like and less of what you can't stand. So give us a like, give us a follow. We'll always hit you back, and we'll always try to reply to everyone. So come say hi. We don't bite. Well, at least Amy doesn't. And she keeps me well fed, so you got nothing to worry about. Now, back to the show.
Speaking of warfare, the events at the end of our last story saw West and Kane get injured. Nothing life-threatening, but enough to get them out of the war with an honourable discharge. Not the fucking West wanted to be out of the war.
Yeah.
In the meantime, Dr. Howard Phillips had begun his medical training in the Miskatonic University back in Arkham. And just like Weston Kane, joined the Canadian military as a student doctor, hoping to help the wounded men in any way he could.
Could any American join the Canadian military?
No. Weston Kane pulled some strings to get enlisted. Phillips' mother was a Brit, so he held dual citizenship. And Canada being under British rule, he was allowed to join. Being a bit of a Herbert West fanboy, Phillips was delighted to find himself stationed alongside Weston Kane on one occasion. Just happened to be in the dying days of their service because, as I said, the result of the drop shell saw the pair injured and honourably discharged from service. Yeah. It would be another 8 years before he saw him again. But to get to that reunion, first we must finish Dr. Kane's confessions and end of his partnership with Dr. Herbert West. So here we go again with the last chapter, part 6, The Tomb Legions. When Dr. Herbert West disappeared a year ago, the Boston police questioned me closely. They suspected that I was holding something back and perhaps suspected graver things. But I could not tell them the truth, because they would not have believed it. They knew, indeed, that West had been connected with activities beyond the credence of ordinary men. For his hideous experiments in the reanimation of dead bodies had long been too extensive to admit of perfect secrecy. But the final soul-shattering catastrophe held elements of demonic fantasy, which make even me doubt the reality of what I saw. I was West's closest friend and only confidential assistant. We had met years before in medical school, and from the first I had shared his terrible researches. He had slowly tried to perfect a solution which, injected into the veins of the newly deceased, would restore life, a labor demanding an abundance of fresh corpses and therefore involving the most unnatural actions. Still more shocking were the products of some of the experiments, grisly masses of flesh that had been dead, but that West waked to a blind, brainless, nauseous animation. These were the usual results. For in order to reawaken the mind, it was necessary to have specimens so absolutely fresh that no decay could possibly affect the delicate brain cells. This need for very fresh corpses had been West's moral undoing. They were hard to get, and one awful day he had secured his specimen while it was still alive and vigorous. A struggle, a needle, and a powerful alkaloid had transformed it to a very fresh corpse, and the experiment had succeeded for a brief and memorable moment. But West had emerged with a soul calloused and seared, and a hardened eye which sometimes glanced with a kind of hideous and calculating appraisal at men of especially sensitive brain and especially vigorous physique. Towards the last, I became acutely afraid of West, for he began to look at me that way. People did not seem to notice his glances, but they noticed my fear, and after his disappearance, used that as a basis for some absurd suspicions. West, in reality, was more afraid than I, for his abominable pursuits entail a life of fruitiveness and dread of every shadow. Partly, it was the police he feared, but sometimes his nervousness was deeper and more nebulous, touching on certain indescribable things into which he had injected a morbid life, and from which he had not seen that life depart. He usually finished his experiments with a revolver, but a few times he had not been quick enough. There was that first specimen on whose rifle grave marks of clawing were later seen. There was also that Arkham professor's body, which had done cannibal things before it had been captured and thrust unidentified into a madhouse cell at Sefton, where it beat the walls for 16 years. Most of the other possibly surviving results were things less easy to speak of, for in later years West's scientific zeal had degenerated to an unhealthy and fantastic mania, and he had spent his chief skill in vitalizing not entire human bodies but isolated parts of bodies, or parts joined to organic matter other than human. It had become fiendishly disgusting by the time he disappeared. Many of the experiments could not even be hinted at in print. World War II, through which both of us served as surgeons, had intensified this side of West. In saying that West's fears of his specimen was nebulous, I have in mind particularly its complex nature. Part of it came merely from knowing of the existence of such nameless monsters, while another part arose from apprehension of the bodily harm they might under certain circumstances do to him. Their disappearance added horror to the situation. Of them all, West knew the whereabouts of only one, the pitiful asylum thing. Then there was a more subtle fear, a fantastic sensation resulting from a curious experiment in the Canadian Army in 1942. West, in the midst of a severe battle, had reanimated Major Sir Eric Morland Chaplain Lee, DSO, a fellow physician who knew about his experiments and could have duplicated them. The head had been removed so that the possibilities of quasi-intelligent life in the trunk might be investigated. Just as the building was wiped out by the German shells, there had been a success. The trunk had moved intelligently, and unbelievable to relate, we were both sickeningly sure that the articulate sound had come from the detached head as it lay in a shadowy corner of the laboratory. The shell had been merciful in a way, but West could never feel as certain as he wished, that we too were the only survivors. He used to make shuddering conjectures about the possible actions of a headless physician with the power of reanimating the dead. West's last quarters were in a venerable house of much elegance, overlooking one of the oldest burying grounds in Boston. He had chosen the place for purely symbolic and fantastical aesthetic reasons, since most of the interments were of the colonial period and therefore of little use to a scientist seeking very fresh bodies. The laboratory was in a sub-cellar secretly constructed by imported workmen and contained a huge incinerator for the quiet and complete disposal of such bodies or fragments and synthetic mockeries of bodies as might remain from the morbid experiments and unhallowed amusements of the owner. During the excavation of this cellar, the workmen had struck some exceedingly ancient masonry, undoubtedly connected with the old burying ground, yet far too deep to correspond with any known sepulchral terrain. After a number of calculations, West decided that it represented some secret chamber between the tombs of the Averills, where the last interment had been made in 1768. I was with him when he studied the nitrous, stripping walls laid bare by the spades and mattocks of the men, and was prepared for the gruesome thrill which would attend to the uncovering of centuried grave secrets. But for the first time, West's new timidity conquered his natural curiosity, and he betrayed his degenerating fiber by ordering the masonry left intact and plastered over. Thus it remained till that final hellish night, part of the walls of the secret laboratory. I speak of West's decadence, but must add that it was a purely mental and intangible thing. Outwardly, he was the same to the last, calm, cold, slight, and yellow-haired, with spectacled blue eyes and a general aspect of youth which years and fears seemed never to change. He seemed calm even when he thought of that clawed grave and looked over his shoulder. Even when he thought of the carnivorous thing that gnawed and pawed at Sefton Bars. The end of Herbert West began one evening in our joint study when he was dividing his curious glances between the newspaper and me. A strange headline item had struck at him from the crumpled pages, and a nameless titan clawed had seemed to reach down through 16 years. Something fearsome and incredible had happened at Sefton Asylum 50 miles away, stunning the neighbourhood and baffling the police. In the small hours of the morning, a body of silent men had entered the grounds and their leader had aroused the attendants. He was a menacing military figure who talked without moving his lips and whose voice seemed almost ventriloquially connected with an immense black case he carried. His expressionless face was handsome to the point of radiant beauty, but it shocked the superintendent when the hall light fell on it, for it was a wax face with eyes of painted glass. Some nameless accident had befallen this man. A larger man guided his steps, a repellent hulk whose bluish face seemed half eaten away by some unknown malady. The speaker had asked for the custody of the cannibal monster committed from Arkham 16 years before, and upon being refused, gave a signal which precipitated a shocking riot. The fiends had beaten, trampled, and bitten every attendant who did not flee, killing four and finally succeeding in the liberation of the monster. Those victims who could recall the event without hysteria swore that the creatures had acted less like man than like unthinkable automata guided by the wax-faced leader. By the time help could be summoned, every trace of the man and of their mad charge had vanished. From the hour of reading this item until midnight, West sat almost paralyzed. At midnight, the doorbell rang, startling him fearfully. All the servants were asleep in the attic, so I answered the bell. As I have told the police, there was no wagon in the street, but only a group of strange-looking figures bearing a large square box which they deposited in the hallway after one of them had grunted in a highly unnatural voice, "Express, prepaid." They filed out of the house with a jerky tread, and as I watched them go, I had an odd idea that they were turning toward the ancient cemetery on which the back of the house abutted. When I slammed the door after them, West came downstairs and looked at the box. It was about 2 feet squared and bore West's correct name and present address. It also bore the inscription from Eric Moreland Chaplin Lee, West Indies. 6 years before the West Indies, a shelled hospital had fallen upon the headless reanimated trunk of Dr. Chapman Lee and upon the detached head which, perhaps, had uttered articulate sounds. West was not even excited now. His condition was more ghastly. Quickly, he said, "It's the finish, but let's incinerate this." We carried the thing down to the laboratory, listening. I do not remember any particulars. You can imagine my state of mind. But it is a vicious lie to say it was Herbert West's body which I put into the incinerator. We both inserted the hole and opened the wooden box, closed the door and started the electricity. Nor did any sound come from the box after all. It was West who first noticed the falling plaster on the part of the wall where the ancient tomb masonry had been covered up. I was going to run, but he stopped me. Then I saw a small black aperture, felt the ghoulish wind of ice, and smelt the charnel bowls of the putrescent earth. There was no sound, but just then the electric lights went out, and I saw outlined against some phosphorescence of the netherworld a horde of silent toiling things which only insanity, or worse, could create. Their outlines were human, semi-human, fractionally human, and not human at all. The horde was grotesquely heterogeneous. They were removing the stones quietly, one by one, from the centuried wall. And then, as the breach became large enough, they came out into the laboratory in single file, led by a stalking thing with a beautiful head made of wax. A sort of mad-eyed monstrosity behind the leader seized on Herbert West. West did not resist or utter a sound. Then they all sprang at him and tore him to pieces before my eyes, bearing the fragments away into the subterranean vault of fabulous abominations. West's head was carried off by the wax-headed leader who wore a Canadian officer's uniform. As it disappeared, I saw that the blue eyes behind the spectacles were hideously blazing with their first touch of frantic, visible emotion. Servants found me unconscious in the morning. West was gone. The incinerator contained only unidentifiable ashes. Detectives have questioned me, but what can I say? The Sefton tragedy, they will not connect with West. Not that, nor the men with the box, whose existence they deny. I told them of the vault, and they pointed to the unbroken plaster wall and laughed. So I told them no more. They implied that I am a madman or a murderer. Probably I am mad. But I might not be mad if those accursed tomb legions had not been so silent. So that's the story of Daniel Kane's experiences with Herbert West.
And according to Kane, he was ripped apart by smart zombies. So how do you explain the next decade of research in his name?
Have you ever heard of the Men in Black?
What does Will Smith have to do with that?
Not the movie, the real Men in Black. It's not like he walked in, slapped the shit out of Herbert West and walked off.
Stranger things have fucking happened.
The Men in Black are a secret group of mysterious US agents said to turn up after bizarre or unexplained events. Their job is to suppress sensitive information by any means necessary. This may sound ominous, but due to their appearance and, well, let's call it negotiation skills or powers of persuasion. The usually pale, white, thin men wore only black suits, sunglasses, and black fedora hats, and from a distance, an MIB appears to be just an average-looking guy. But on closer inspection, it's said that the MIB generally have thin lips, which appear to be drawn on, with some witnesses claiming that along with little to no lips, the MIB had no hair or eyelashes. They appear to be frail or sickly, but it is said that when you're in their presence, you are very aware that you are around someone dangerous. Someone not quite fully human, something almost unnatural. Do you remember...
No.
Oh, I'd like to hear this in a minute, but okay. Do you remember I said at the start of the first part of this,
yeah,
where you were asking, well, how the fuck would they keep so many people quiet about something like a zombie attack?
Yeah.
And I pointed out that they managed to keep the whole of Roswell quiet.
Yeah.
They managed to keep the whole of Roswell quiet.
Well, that's true.
It was the Men in Black. It's believed, like, the people of Roswell, like, had made claims of Men in Black coming to their door, yeah, to tell them, you saw fucking nothing.
Sure.
Do you know? No, they say it in a nice way, that they're supposed to be very gentle. So they're supposed to sound like inhuman the way they talk. Like they don't really know properly how to speak. They'll say really kind of vague, kind of normal, small talk kind of questions and then kind of slightly drop the hint of like you don't want
to. How are you doing?
Yeah. And where was that from?
Resident Alien.
Yeah, essentially, it is like Resident Evil, like fucking what's his name from Resident Evil.
He doesn't know how to intonate.
Yeah. When he first gets there, yeah, dealing with humans, but at the same, not as goofy. And yeah, they don't need to be violent because there is something about their presence that makes you feel like you are in absolute fucking danger, yeah, and you need to do as you're fucking,
yeah,
told.
Yeah.
Some even say like it could be a psychological thing that they're like, you know, getting into your head, you know.
Creepy.
And some have even said that they have heard them without seeing their lips moved.
Oh my god, so, this is just making me more convinced that... Do you remember in Buffy?
Okay.
Okay, and you know the guys when she got up one morning and she opened up her curtains and there's like these white ball guys floating around and I don't think they spoke either.
No, I can't remember this.
Oh my god, they're creepy. They're like all white, but like it looks like they've drawn black on their lips.
Maybe they were supposed to be a take on the Men in Black. I wouldn't be surprised for something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer to have the Men in Black in it.
I think they're
you know, they base their own kind of conspiracy and paranormal.
Like these were kind of monster kind of.
Yeah, maybe they're based off it though.
Suits, like, but they could have been based off it. So you're claiming what? That they were the ones to have come for Herbert. So how do you explain what Kane claims to have seen?
Drugged, hallucinogen. I believe that if you look at how West is acting at the end of the last story, he knew it was coming. He was waiting for it.
Mm.
Do you know? I think West was approached by US agents and promised limitless resource to continue his work in a worry-free, sanctioned environment. All the bodies he need, no question asked, and I think it was his dream job. And if you look at what Daniel Kane said at the end of the story, when he told police that West had went through the tunnel under the house, they turned around and started laughing and pointed to the untouched wall, like the wall was in perfect condition.
Yeah.
So it was only Daniel Kane that saw it falling apart, that saw the wall coming off, that saw the bricks being taken down one by one, that saw the monsters coming out and grabbing West and ripping him apart. And West is supposed to have just stood there calmly throughout all of it.
Nah.
So, I mean, and he even himself admits that he is not sure if what he saw was real or if it was imaginary.
Yeah. So what happened to Herb in the end?
Well, according to Dr. Phillips, the first few years were bliss, with the pair of them working away alongside another man by the name of Dr. Matthew Logan. The early years showed promise, with small wins coming regularly enough. The main hurdle was the mind. Reanimating a body was easy. Just stimulate the central nervous system and bang, they're up and moving. But with no mind came no control, and the specimen would always revert to a feral state, regardless of how fresh the corpse was. As Dr. Phillips put it, they could cure death, but not the trauma of the mind brought on by the experience.
Yeah, it's poetic and all, but really it was the brain cells rapidly deteriorating after death that they couldn't cure.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. As the Cold War began to heat up, so did the need for more powerful weapons. This led the US government to shift plans. The doctors were making no progress with brain function restoration, so officials decided instead of seeing trioxin as a reagent, they would look at it as a potential weapon.
Like you said in the last episode, they drop it onto the enemy men, infecting them and making them a problem for the enemy to clean up while the US invaded from another direction or afterwards while the enemy was weak.
Yeah. Now, for all his faults, Herbert West was in this game to revive people and cure death. So he was less than impressed when he found out that the US was now using his research as a deadly weapon. He saw the potential for total global annihilation in the way the US were treating it. And after many disagreements with his superiors, West quit the research and refused to share his notes or ideas any further. According to Phillips, their superiors were in no form to fool around with the fear that Russia could strike at any time. They wanted the trioxin ready ASAP so they could use it as a deterrent before the nukes came out. Phillips claims that West quit on the 2nd of January 1980. Within 2 weeks, West was found dead in his quarters of an apparent suicide. His suicide note left his studies and notes to the US government and was shared with Phillips and Logan not long after West's quick funeral. His body was cremated and his ashes scattered into the mountainside of the Everglades. All records of his existence were scrubbed by the US government and he was never mentioned in any official records again. Now, with all that said, I've detailed 3 incidents. You yourself have covered 2 more. Along with that, we have the history behind the reagent with Dr. Kane's confessions diary. So, has any of that done anything to sway your opinion on the possibility of the Walking Dead being possible?
Yeah, maybe a little. I mean, it's always in the back of your head, isn't it? Of all the monsters in a cinematic world, like zombies have always been the most possible due to the fact that we've put great minds to work on the subject. Some for the love of discovery, some in search for more immortality, and some in the search for bigger, better weapons.
You know what? I can live with that. I'll take it as a win and move on because 3 weeks of zombie talk has my brain fried and I'll come eating it soon if I don't fucking get done with it. I'm ready to get on to something new is what I'm saying.
Yeah, like this was supposed to be a 1 week thing. Then it went to 2 and then 2 became 3.
Trust me, it could have went a lot further. We've only scratched the surface of zombie conspiracy theories, and it's definitely something we will revisit again in the future.
More zombies, can't wait.
Until then, you know what to do. Follow us on socials at Alive Alive Pod and check out our Patreon. Not your Patreon, fuck your Patreon. No, we'll check out your Patreon. Check out our Patreon at It's Alive Alive Pod for great shows like our true crime show, Real Monsters, and Amy's great history podcast, Playing With Bones, along with classic episodes of Behind the Mask and early access to Creepypasta Crypt and Mini Monsters.
All that, and you get ad-free access to our main show and the weekend update, all for just €5 a month. That's on Patreon at It's Alive Alive Pod.
Until then, we'll be back next Wednesday with more tales from the horrorverse. It's Alive Alive Podcast, all the guts and gore with none of the guilt. See you all next time, same Alive Alive time, same horrorverse channel. Okay, love you, bye-bye.